things like being one of the, you know, only young women female engineers at IBM was never uncomfortable to me. You know, being one of few female technical CEOs never felt uncomfortable to me. So I don't know. I think maybe it has to do with just sort of how I was brought up. I'll also say, you can't tell this from this, you know, video call, but I'm under 5 feet. I'm on the shorter side. And when people haven't met me in person, they tend to think that I get all the time when I meet them in person, like, oh my God, you're so much smaller than I thought you were. You're so much more petite than I thought you were. And so it's funny.
They think
actually
you're 5'9 or 5'10.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this on Zoom or whatever.
Yeah. One of my investors, and Rob Hayes from First Round, who I love and adore, he and I have told this story before. He decided to invest in TaskRabbit with a couple of phone calls just over the phone. He was traveling and like we just couldn't meet in person. And so when we finally met in person, it was our first board meeting with them on board as an investor. And I walked into the room and Rob was sitting there at the table and he jumped up so surprised and he was like, oh my God, you're so much smaller than I thought you were.
Thanks for joining us. Legends and Losers is brought to you by Oracle NetSuite. Are you ready to turbocharge your growth? Check out netsuite.com/legends. Today, we hang out with a great entrepreneur. Actually, she's an engineer turned entrepreneur turned venture capitalist named Leah Buskey. She's a VC at Fuel Capital, and she's having one of those dream careers. She's an incredibly endearing person. She's the founder of one of the category queen companies in the gig economy, TaskRabbit, who famously got acquired by IKEA. She shares her journey from engineer to entrepreneur to startup investor. We talk about how to bring on a COO and ultimately how to hand your business over to the CEO so that that person can become the CEO, how to sell your company to IKEA, become a VC, and why Leah Buskey wants women to shine together.
Hello, my legendary friends. This is Legends and Losers, the show for people who like to eavesdrop on killer dialogues, brilliant rants, and crazy diversions, straight up with a business twist. Hosted by Christopher Lockhead, former three-time CMO and co-author of Play Bigger, who has one of the most strategic minds in marketing, but could also hide his own Easter eggs. And now, strap yourselves in. It's time for Legends and Losers.
All right, all right, all right. Joy Ramone said, hey ho, let's go. And Margaret Mead said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Isn't that a great quote? It's one of my favorites of all time. Welcome to Legends and Losers, where we aspire to have conversations worth sharing. We explore how being a loser is actually the path to being a legend. We try to talk about how to design a legendary business and a legendary life. And every once in a while, we veer off course and chase zebras down rabbit holes and talk about things like why Americans drive so slowly in the left-hand lane and how much scotch is appropriate to drink at the company meeting. Now, before we get started with Leah, I want to do some thank yous and shout outs. It's been probably too long. So first, I'd like to say to the Storato Group, thank you so much for your awesome, heartfelt Facebook shout out. To the countless people who have recommended or reviewed Niche Down on Amazon.com. It really means a ton to Heather and I that you do it. So thank you, Frank Sell, Dan Moyle, Isaac Morehouse, Tom Schwab, Jordan Thomas, Shaku Atre, Scott Athan, Casey McCoy, Julie Reisler, David Schimberg, Raymond Cadmus, I hope I'm saying that right, Rob Brennan, Jess Harless, Brandy Salazar, the incomparable Dushka Zapata, Nathan Hayes, Candy and Sean Douglas, Mike Hernandez, Matt Kubler, and Colby Barr, and all of the anonymous reviewers from the bottom of my heart, and I think I can say from the bottom of Heather's heart, thank you so much for your incredible reviews on Amazon of Niche Down. Also want to say a quick shout out to Greg Canty. Thank you for your ongoing Twitter love, Greg. Bob O'Brien, you are incredible. Thank you, brother, for your incredible, detailed, heartfelt review of Niche Down on LinkedIn. It means the world to me that you'd go out of your way to do something so thoughtful. Also want to thank our good friends at GrowWire.com, the place that entrepreneurs are reading good shit on the internet. They recently named me, quote, one of the 25 business experts every entrepreneur should follow. I don't know how they made that mistake, but thank you so much, GrowWire.com. And Aaron Tickle? Oh, God, I'm butchering it for sure. Here comes the dyslexia. Anyway, Aaron, I want to thank you so much for your awesome iTunes review. And also want to shout out, most of the iTunes reviews lately seem to be coming from anonymous people. I don't care whether you're anonymous or not. Thank you so much. And Aaron, maybe send an email to blackhole@legendsandlosers.com and tell me how to pronounce your last name. All right. Today's guest was introduced by my dear friend and our guest most recently on episode 188, Anne Miracco, the incredible, incomparable co-founder of Floodgate Capital, one of the smartest people I know, Leah Buskey. And not working with Leah when she had was in the early stages of TaskRabbit was a true losery moment for me. Leah and I had a conversation, and I'm not exactly sure what went wrong. I'm almost positive it was me, and for one reason or another, Leah and I did not end up working together. Had we worked together, I might have had a chance to not only work with an amazing person and her team, but also enjoy some of the outcome of TaskRabbit when it got acquired by IKEA. But that's just another example of I'm going to lose a lot more money in life than I have ever made. Anyway, she couldn't be more endearing. She couldn't be more compelling. Today, she's a partner at Fuel Capital. I'm stoked to have this conversation and that she's still willing to talk to me. Check out our show notes for more on her incredible background or how to find her on Twitter and elsewhere on the social web at legendsandlosers.com. Now, here she is, Leah Buskey.
When I founded TaskRabbit in 2008, the timing wasn't planned, but it ended up being an incredible time to start a company based around new ways of working because of the massive financial crisis that we hit in September of that year. I really feel like that was the catalyst. That was the precipice. That's when I started to see everything shift and change around how people thought about the future of work. No longer was there so much stability in these companies. I mean, my parents' generation would stay in their jobs for 30 plus years. My dad retired from the same job after 32 years. That just wasn't the norm any longer. And I think that does come from the instability of the financial markets. And I think with the emergence of these new flexible ways of working, such as TaskRabbit, people loved it. They loved the flexibility. We once did a survey of the 60,000 taskers we have across the US and the UK, and we asked them, what is the most important thing to you? Is it making money? Is it the flexibility? Is it something else? And overwhelmingly, almost 70% of taskers said flexibility over money, which was a shock to me. And so I think that the flexibility in the future of work is one big pillar, one big category. And over the course of the last decade, we've just seen that pillar, that value, kind of explode across all these different companies and all these different new ways of working. And people like it. They've latched onto it. And now the customer, the consumer, is really driving, I think, this philosophy and this thinking into the future.
And, you know, when I hear you talk about that, I think that maybe some people could think, well, maybe there's a trade-off. I trade security of a job with the flexibility of being, would you call them freelancers, or what word would you use for this gig economy? What do you call that?
I like to call them freelancers. I mean, a lot of people, I think, talk about the gig economy and gig workers. I think that, to me, that feels really demeaning. Like I have an issue with people undermining and demeaning this type of work, or even just flexibility in work. The fact that someone would actually want to control their schedule and control their time and choose who they want to work with, I think that's more empowering than it is demeaning. Now, I think your point around stability, benefits, 401k, retirement, healthcare, all of these other things that come with traditional stability in work definitely change when you're a freelancer, when you're in more in control of your own schedule and who you work for. I think the future is going to have to marry the two. I don't think it's an either or, and it shouldn't be. Why should it be? Because for, 50 years, this is how the U.S. economy was set up. Like, it makes no sense to me. So I think that that will change, but it's going to take the continued push and innovation, not only of companies, but of workers and of employees that are asking for this to make those changes happen.
The other thing I'd be curious to get your reaction, Leah, is it used to be that you could go get a job at, I'll just pick a company, General Electric or AT&T or, if you were in healthcare, some big hospital or whatever it is, and do like your folks, do like my mom worked at the same place for, I don't know exactly how many years, but more than 30, and then retired, and that's how it goes, that is less and less possible, never mind the fact that maybe that's less and less desirable. Mm-hmm. How do you react to that?
I mean, I think both of those points are true. I think it goes back to the question around stability. The workforce is changing. These companies are changing. They're bringing in sort of the next generation of workers. And the demands are different. The expectations are different. So you're going to be hard-pressed to find a 22-year-old that has it in their head they're going to stay at GE for the next 30 years, right? Like, that's just probably not going to happen. I stayed at IBM. My first job out of college was at IBM. I was there for 8 years. And I honestly, my mental model were my parents. My dad, worked for the government. He was in the Air Force. He was a civilian, but he worked at Hanscom Air Force Base in Massachusetts for 32 years. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. So that was my mental model. And I thought, I got this great job at IBM out of college. I'm a programmer. I'm an engineer. I love this work. I love technology. I love my team. I'm learning a lot. And IBM is 400,000 people. There are going to be tons of places that I can move my career and change teams and sort of climb this corporate ladder. I thought I'd stay there forever. Not to mention that IBM has been named time and time again as one of the number one companies for women to work, right? Which, if we're going to speak honesty here, like, as a young woman, these are things that you think about.
Unpack what is it that you think about as a quote-unquote young woman looking for your first or an early job?
For me, I thought, like, wow, IBM continues to win all these awards around women at work, supporting women at work. I'm 22 when I start there. And I'm thinking, this is going to be great for me. I'm going to have a great career path. I'm going to get the support that I need to succeed in this system, right? In this corporation, whether that means corporate development, retraining, learning new roles, learning new jobs, leave, maternity leave. I didn't have my children until much, much later, like 15 years later. But I thought, like, at some point I'm going to want to have a family and kids, and like being at a place that has that stability and support system is going to be a good thing for me. Not to mention that all of the jobs I've ever had in my life have been very male dominated. Certainly a programming job at IBM, I was one of the very few women. I was one of very few, actually, people under the age of 30.
What was that like to be a younger woman engineer? And you were actually slinging code, were you not?
I was, mostly C++. And a lot of, 10 to 15 year old code base. I mean, it was pretty like back end hardcore programming, which was super fun.
And how many female colleagues did you have working on C++ back end programming with you?
On my team, there are 15 people on my team, and there was one other woman who had been at IBM for a long time. She had been there 19 years.
And we hear a lot about, women in engineering, obviously women in tech. One of the pioneers we feature in our new book, Niche Down, is Debbie, I want to say her last name is Sterling. I apologize if I'm
Yeah, from Goldilocks. She's amazing. Yeah, she's amazing. Yeah.
And one of the things that blew me away about her was the Goldilocks. She partnered with the Girl Scouts to create a STEM merit badge. Did you hear about this?
Yep. Yep.
And so this is all very cool shit, but you know, this was not going on, I'm guessing, when you were a little gal, a little girl no. growing up, right?
No, it's a totally different generation and way of thinking, which I mean, I think is amazing. I have a 5-year-old daughter now, and she loves to play office. And, you know, when I was a 5-year-old girl, most of my friends were playing home or wedding or, you know, like family. And so it's just different. It's just a different generation. It's a different way of thinking. I think what Debbie has done is incredible, and it's going to take continued innovation around that. I also think about Reshma, who runs Girls Who Code, who's just created this incredible footprint of middle school and high school girls across the country that are doing these coding camps, that are going to college knowing how to code, knowing what C++ and Java and Ruby on Rails is. I had zero exposure to anything computer related until I got to college. And then I ended up being a computer science major at college. And so I'm really excited about where we're going. I mean, there's certainly a lot of work to do, but the generational shift is happening.
And so maybe walk me through your headset at the time. It sounds like you got a great job at IBM. It sounds like you really liked slinging code. Mm-hmm. But then you, of course, end up being an entrepreneur. And you founded a company, TaskRabbit, that not only in of itself is an important startup, but also you were a real pioneer in, as we were talking about a few moments ago, in a whole new model for creating employment. And so how do you go from, hey, I'm slinging code, to I want to start a company and I want to be this kind of pioneer?
I know. Well, you know, usually in these types of interviews or podcasts, they're very short. And so I have to give the short answer. I'll give sort of the more authentic, longer answer.
You can give the longest answer you want.
Yeah.
You can chase anything down any rabbit hole you like.
Yeah, it's awesome. So, you know, I tell the story about being at IBM and then having this moment of inspiration in 2008 where I was at a dog food one night and I was like, there's got to be someone that can get me this dog food in the neighborhood. And the iPhone had just come out. And so there were emerging technology trends that I was really excited about. And I saw a way to build this network, to build this platform at that moment. But it really was not about that moment. It was about everything that led there. And I would say 5 years into IBM, I loved my job. I loved programming. I loved my team. But I was starting to feel like, maybe there are other skills that I want to be using on a daily basis. And I was starting to get a little bit bored. And so that's 3 years of staying at IBM, of continuing to do my job.
So
but
I
thinking,
hate to interrupt
like,
you, but I just want to make sure yeah. I understand. That's 3 years after the aha about the dog food.
No, actually, okay. This is 3 years before.
3 years before. Excuse me.
Yeah. So, yeah. So leading up to that aha moment was about 3 years. And in those 3 years, I started thinking about what are these other skills that I want to use on a daily basis. And once a year at IBM, there was this massive conference called Lotusphere. I worked on Lotus Notes and Domino. And it was the one time a year that they let the developers actually talk to the customers directly. And they flew us all down to Disney World and Orlando, and it was like 15,000 customers came from all over the globe. And there was this Meet the Developers lab. And when I started getting invitations to go down and be one of the developers that the customers could meet, I was so energized. I was so excited about talking directly to people who were utilizing the product, who were using the code that I was writing on a daily basis. And so I got a lot of energy from customers. And I think that was an insight for me, like, oh, could I find a career where I could actually do more here, where I could have that direct connection in solving customers' problems on a daily basis. And so that was one insight I had. And then, so, you know, as part of that 3-year process and 3-year journey, I started to poke around just nights and weekends and started to think about what are some other ideas I could have? Are there apps on the side I could build? One of the first apps I built and launched was in the real estate industry. My husband and I were living in Boston and we were looking at buying our first home together. And the real estate market still remains really hard to navigate. And so I had started building all these little apps on the side and launching them. And talk about failures. Like, they were complete failures. So I kept my day job.
Around here, we invented a word to make failing sound better than it is. We call it losery.
There's lots of losery happening. Lots of it.
I hate to interrupt you again, but
yeah.
How do you think that losery that was happening, you said lots of losery, how did that affect you?
It got me to that moment of inspiration, and it got me the confidence to say, this is the one, this is the thing that I am supposed to do. And so, you know, even though you call it a failure or losery, like I don't believe in any of that. I just feel like everything you do leads to where you are today. And so I had to go through all of those experiences and all of those moments to be able to have the idea for TaskRabbit, to not only have the idea, but to actually realize that it was something interesting and that it was something that could be high impact and that would change the world for the better. And that's really what I was looking for too. I mean, I'm someone who looks for ways that I can uniquely impact anything I'm doing. I tend to get very bored or disinterested in anything I'm doing, whether it be project work, nonprofit work, you know, investor work, where you could slot someone else in and someone else could do that job. Like, I don't need to be there. I like to work on things where I feel like I can have a unique impact. And so it took all of...
How do you decide what things you can have a unique impact on and what you can't?
Well, you know, that's taken time and it's still a learning process. I think I'm pretty self-aware. And so understanding where my skills are, not only where my skills are, but where I tend to get the most passionate about. If I get really passionate about something, you know, clearly I am really passionate about TaskRabbit and the future of work. Like, I can work for a decade on that company and be totally fulfilled and totally happy. And then continue on in my next career in investing and continue to focus on the future of work. That's an area I'm passionate about. So I think passion is one thing. You know, I think passion lends itself to drive, and drive lends itself to success. And what I mean by that is anything that's worth working on is going to be hard, is going to be challenging. You're going to hit walls, you're going to hit roadblocks, and you have to have the drive and passion not only to like work around them and go over them, you have to bust through them and you have to be willing to bust through them. And so those are the things that I look for and want to work on. Like, what's a really hard problem where I feel like I have a unique skill set and the passion behind it to help bust through walls.
So maybe we can unpack this a little bit, because we live in a society where everything is increasingly convenient. I can go to TaskRabbit and have somebody come over and tie my shoes for me if I don't want to bend over. You know, we're moving.
You could have a broken back or a broken leg. I mean, it's these are real world scenarios.
No, I know. But I mean, you are a creator of, if I could call it such, the sort of mega convenience economy where you could really pay anybody to do virtually anything. And, you know, Amazon's trying to figure out how to deliver us drones, and, you know, self-driving pizza vans are 3D printing pizza on their way over. And, you know, so we just live in this world of convenience, massive convenience, and it's escalating. Mm-hmm. And we also kind of live in a world that sort of teaches us that success or happiness is equals comfort in a lot of ways. So when I hear you talk, what I hear you saying is you're talking about struggle, you're talking about challenges and problems that you want to take on, and you're talking about, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but pushing yourself beyond maybe what you think you might be able to achieve or something. You know, you're up to some big shit around some big problems, and you're doing it in a world of convenience and of comfort. And so why are you driven to do hard shit as opposed to just sit on the couch and eat Cheetos?
Damn, no one's ever asked me that question. And I'm not sure I've ever thought about it that way, but you're right. I mean, when I'm comfortable, I'm bored. I don't know. Gosh, I don't even know where that comes from. I think, well, let me take a stab at it now that I'm thinking about it in real time. I don't know. I think I've always sort of grown up with this chip on my shoulder and this sense of adversity. And maybe I'm just kind of used to that. And that's kind of what I've known. Not to say that I haven't lived a comfortable life. Like, my parents brought us up in very rural Massachusetts, middle-class family. We had a wonderful life. We have a wonderful life. Younger sister. And again, like, dad, 30 years in the Air Force, mom, stay-at-home mom. I grew up in an ethnically diverse family. So my father is Puerto Rican. And that isn't something I talk about a lot because it's not something I think about a lot, but there's definitely been certain moments in my life where people have made that clear to me that it's different, right? Like, it's unique. I mean, I remember being called a racist term in middle school by some, you know, little boy and thinking like, oh my God, why did...
I don't want to get too personal, but do you want to share what that term was?
I mean, I wouldn't even say it out loud again, but it's a four-letter word that starts with an S. And I think that growing up in a very rural area, my town was like 4,000 people. We, K through 8, was in one building for school. We didn't have a high school in my town. We went to a regional high school. And so I entered high school knowing no one and having to like build up a network in these like really tumultuous, you know, age defining critical years of life.
And did you go from a small school to a giant school? Was that part of it too?
That was also part of it too. Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I think that I had an incredible upbringing, but there is certainly, you know, moments of adversity. I was the first woman in my family to go to college. And so I think I've just always lived maybe in that world. And maybe that's where I am comfortable. I mean, maybe for me, that is comfortable. Because it doesn't feel uncomfortable to me. And actually, you know, things like being one of the, you know, only young women, female engineers at IBM was never uncomfortable to me. You know, being one of few female technical CEOs never felt uncomfortable to me. So I don't know. I think maybe it has to do with just sort of how I was brought up. I'll also say you can't tell this from this, you know, video call, but I'm under 5 feet. I'm on the shorter side. And when people haven't met me in person, they tend to think that I get all the time when I meet them in person, like, oh my God, you're so much smaller than I thought you were. You're so much more petite than I thought you were. And so it's funny.
They think
actually
you're 5'9" or 5'10".
Yeah.
On Zoom or whatever.
Yeah. One of my investors and Rob Hayes from First Round, who I love and adore. He and I have told this story before. He decided to invest in TaskRabbit with a couple of phone calls just over the phone. He was traveling and like, we just couldn't meet in person. And so when we finally met in person, it was our first board meeting with them on board as an investor. And I walked into the room and Rob was sitting there at the table and he jumped up so surprised. And he was like, oh my God, you're so much smaller than I thought you were. And he was like, so taken aback by it. I startled him and we were laughing and I gave him a hug and he's like, no, really, your whole presence on the phone was so much larger than what I had in my head. And I think that, I mean, I don't know. It's a good example because I think my whole life I was also underestimated because of just my size and stature. Right. And so maybe that was a component too that has led to me being a little more comfortable with adversity, probably a little more on the feisty side than not, because I've been constantly underestimated my entire life.
Yeah, I relate to that. My wife, Carrie, is 5 feet tall. And she is an absolute locomotive of results. She is a highly trained Muay Thai kickboxer.
Whoa.
She's highly trained in Israeli Krav Maga. And
that's amazing. You know,
if a 200-pound, 6-foot man tried to do something untoward to her,
my God.
Definitely put him in the hospital, and she might put him in a box.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I understand this petite woman who's on fire on this stuff. Now, I got to ask you, you did say something at the beginning of that where you mentioned having a chip on your shoulder.
Mm.
Could you unpack that chip for me maybe a little, Leah?
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe I've always felt like I've had a lot to prove, and maybe that stems from coming from a place where, you know, it was very rural. Like my context and my mindset for what was normal just was different than I think what I always wanted. And what I've always wanted is to be able to have that impact. Another example, I remember being 8 years old and starting my first company, which was called Pollution Solutions. And it was a recycling program in my elementary school. And I called myself the CEO. I hired my little sister and my cousin to kind of boss around and help me implement this recycling program. So I always wanted to have an impact, right? That's always what's driven me. That's always what I've looked for. But I haven't necessarily grown up with a clear path around how to do that. And so I've had to figure that out along the way. And I've had a lot to prove along the way because, you know, I don't come with sort of the typical pattern matching or the typical pedigree or their typical profile that people would expect. And so that's probably where that chip comes from.
And who are you proving this stuff to, Leah?
Probably mostly myself.
Isn't that interesting? I'm curious to ask you because I have had, I don't have it anymore, a giant chip on my shoulder, particularly as a young man. And from probably 18 to maybe even 30, it was in my head anyway, it was like, oh yeah, fuck you. I'm going to show you. Like I'm going to give it, I'm going to stick it to the man or the woman or whoever it was who I felt like I was going to prove it to. And of course, you know, just like a prize fighter, one day you sort of wake up with a little bit of perspective, or at least I did, and said, you know, I'm proving it to me. There's really only one opponent I'm fighting, and that's myself.
Yeah.
And so I guess is that how it is for you? And if it is, then I have a sort of a follow-up question.
Not that I don't want your follow-up question, but I'm not sure it's just like that for me. I think that I don't see the chip as being this like aggressive, adversarial thing. I guess I see it more as a motivation just to do more. Like I always feel like there's more to do. I guess I'm never satisfied with where I am or what I'm doing. I think that's what it is, actually.
Okay, well, then that's interesting. So maybe we can unpack that. How do you, on one hand, not be satisfied, which sounds like it's a big part of your drive? Yes?
Yes.
How do you, in your head, think about that in the context of being a happy person? In other words, can you be happy and unsatisfied at the same time? Or are you miserable because you're unhappy?
No, that's a good question. Yes. So I am a happy person. But I'm also, you know, not satisfied with where I am at any given time. I am a big believer in the journey, though. Like, I have perspective on it is a journey. It is about the journey more than it is about the end result. You know, I thought a lot when I was running TaskRabbit on a daily basis about what would make us successful and how do I define success? And I think what I realized, and this was over time through multiple people and coaches and things, that defining success for me isn't about winning necessarily. I want to win. I'm very competitive, very, very competitive. But success for me is defined as winning, but also, did I operate with impact? What are my values? What sort of impact am I having over the long term? And so I think I'm able to take a long-term view towards what success looks like over time, enjoy the journey along the way, be okay with the failures and the losers that are going to drive you to that next milestone, to that next point, to that next learning. And so I think I have perspective and awareness around the journey as well as where I am at any given moment.
So you feel like you can be happy and dissatisfied, or happy and have this chip, or happy and have this thing to prove at the same time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, with TaskRabbit, it was a decade-long journey of proving out the vision of the future of work and empowering this new workforce. Now that I'm investing full-time at Fuel, I'm just starting my investment journey. And I've been here a year, and, you know, we've done some great investments. I realize I won't know for a decade what sort of impact I've actually had as an investor.
Yeah.
And that's okay with me. You know, like that is the
job. You're
willing
to play the long game.
That's right.
It's interesting. I don't know if you find this, and I think it's increasingly the case because of the world that we live in and, you know, Snapchats and tweets and all this shit, that the number of people willing to play the long game is amazing. You know, I'm in this new world of author, podcaster, guy world. And I forget the exact numbers, Leah, but you know, there's over 500,000 podcasts. And I think the average podcaster stops after less than a year.
Wow.
Right? Because they just, you know, they see that if your podcast gets 201 downloads an episode on average, you're in the top 50 percentile, right? So most podcasts have a relatively small audience. And I think what happens is people get excited. They go do it. They expect that they're going to be, you know, as the comedian, is her name Allie Lee? Angie Lee? She did Cobra Baby. She's the gal. She's done two specials, very pregnant. She's incredible.
Yes. Oh my God. So funny.
So funny. And she calls she calls them the motivational type. She calls them Deepak Oprah, you know? So they expect you're going to launch a podcast and three episodes in, you're going to be Deepak Oprah. And of course, that's not what happens. And so they don't get that immediate positive response and they stop doing it. And so I guess that all leads me to a question, which is, you know, how is it possible? I mean, you certainly played a very long game at TaskRabbit, and of course the company continues forward, and I have a few things I want to touch on with you there, but how is it you're able to play the long game?
Well, even prior to TaskRabbit, I mean, 8 years at IBM was a pretty long game too. I've been married to my high school sweetheart for 16 years. That's a pretty long game too, right? So I think maybe going
back.
Last
time I checked, committing to making people is a pretty long game as well, isn't it?
Right? Yeah. Two kids, five and two, who are just awesome. Yeah. I mean, I think it goes back to maybe how I grew up too, and that mental context I had, and, you know, seeing my father excel and succeed and, you know, serve his government for 32 years, seeing my mom so dedicated to our family, and to focusing on us kids, for her, you know, lifetime and career. Maybe it's the merging of that context with this entrepreneurial drive that I've always had that kind of puts me somewhere in between. I don't know.
Very interesting. Now, if we go to TaskRabbit for a sec, you absolutely designed a company, product or service, if you will, and really a category. You designed a whole new category of service. So in sort of niche down parlance, play bigger parlance, you prosecuted the magic triangle. You got company, product/service, and category right. And so now with a little bit of perspective on it, how do you think about the success that you had and the company continues to have at TaskRabbit?
Yeah, I mean, I tell the story that very early on, back in 2009, 2010, you know, it wasn't clear that we were going to be successful. You know, it wasn't like I just coded up this platform, got it launched, and it was this big hockey stick, right? That people talk about that. That's just not the reality, I think, of any startup. And so there were definitely many times that we struggled, but I always knew very early on that we would be successful. I didn't know if we'd win in the space. I don't know. I didn't know if we got it quite right, if we were going to be, you know, the number one and take the market share and be the big driver of revenue. But I knew that we'd be successful, and here's why. We were only open in two cities, Boston and San Francisco. And there was this job that came in, and it was this mom in San Francisco that had a 20-year-old son living in Boston. And unfortunately, he was going through chemotherapy treatment at Mass General Hospital, and she couldn't fly out there to be with him in person. So she went on the TaskRabbit website. She found someone to go to the hospital every day for a week, sit with him for 30 minutes, bring him a warm blanket, a healthy meal, have a conversation, and then call her afterwards every single day and give her the real update. The person that picked up this job in Boston was actually another mom. And the bond that these two moms formed across the country was incredible. And we heard from both of them that this had happened, right? Like we weren't monitoring all these tasks and jobs. Like they reached out and said, like, this was special. This was amazing. And I realized at that moment that we would be successful, that we were having an impact, that we were changing the way you could rely on neighbors and your community, because we were leveraging technology in a way that brought everyone together. And so, you know, our success continued from there. And again, you can define success in different ways. Certainly opening new markets, you know, 44 markets across the country, London, our first international market was a huge deal. We felt very successful when we did that. Each time we raised a round of funding, it felt like a huge success. We raised about $50 million over the course of the company. But those fundraises were hard. They were really hard and really difficult. They came in 8 tranches, $50 million. And I pitched 8 rounds of funding, 8 different times. I mean, pitched hundreds of investors, got hundreds of no's. But it was about pushing through. And so to see the impact and to see the success of the company persist, to see that we found this amazing partner and acquirer in IKEA, which has aligned values and aligned culture around the impact that they want to see in the world, that feels like success to me, and is really exciting to look back on. So I don't know, it's a mix. Like I look back on the last decade and I remember everything. I remember all of the hard times and the little wins and the big wins and the hard losses and the small losses and everything in between. But in the end, you know, I can look back and feel really proud about the impact we've had and what we did. We were really early. We were really early in the market, maybe a little too early, honestly.
As you should. And me not working with you, I consider one of the failures in my career. As you may remember, we got introduced when you were pretty early, and I was a skeptic, and so I certainly...
Dude, you probably could have helped us in a major way at that moment in time.
I know, I was so
stupid.
You
know?
You just...
It's okay. Certainly. I won't hold it against you.
Yeah, well, I thank you for not holding it against me. I hold it against me, though, because I missed an opportunity to be part of something special, and it just shows you... you know, we learn more from the losery, not sort of pursuing the opportunity to work with you. I consider a really stupid fuck up in my career.
Oh my God. Well, I don't give it a second thought. It's all good. But that, I mean, that's really nice of you to
it's
say
true.
Too.
Now, I'm curious, you did so many things at TaskRabbit that, you know, really powerful. One of them that's on my mind is you made the transition from, you were the CEO, yes?
Yes.
And of course you were the founder, but you made the transition to another CEO who of course was not a founder. And
yep.
That handing of the baton is often probably, at least in my experience, I don't have data, but in my experience in 32 years in business and 22 years in Silicon Valley, that is a handoff where the baton often gets dropped. And that was absolutely not the case with TaskRabbit. So could you share a little about how you did that with me?
Yeah, absolutely. It was not easy, and I fucked it up one time. Like, I don't know if you know the whole history, but I tried to do it once before.
I didn't realize
it really fucked it up. Yeah. And I think it's good to focus on like what went right the second time and like how I did it, because I think people can learn from that success. And we were very successful. And there are definitely key learnings that I have that made it successful. So let's focus there. But there was definitely some failures and some losery that helped me get it right the second time. So with Stacy, I had recruited her out of Google. She had been at Google for 9 years. It took me 2 years to get her out of Google. Her and I met 2 years before she started working for me at TaskRabbit. I wanted to bring in a COO. I wanted to bring in a partner. I was a solo founder, and it was really lonely. And I wanted to have someone that was in it with me in the day-to-day. And of course, there's so many other people and team members and early employees and my husband and, you know, Anne at Floodgate as well, who were so supportive and were part of that founding team. But like as a CEO, you don't share everything of the day-to-day. You just can't. It's exhausting. And so I was looking for that partner, met Stacy, and took me 2 years, and I finally got her, and I was so happy and so excited. In that 2 years, we had built a friendship. We had built a mentorship relationship. I would show her board decks before I was presenting to the board. She didn't know she was part of a process in my search for a COO.
Evil plan that you were working.
Yes. From day one. She knows this now. She's like, you just like reeled me in. Like I had no idea what was going on. And then all of a sudden I'm meeting board members, I'm meeting team members. You're giving me offer to join the company. I'm like, came out of nowhere. It was part of my evil plan the whole time. So I knew that I wanted her. She came on as COO and it changed my world. It changed the company. And we worked hand in hand together for over 4 years. Me as CEO, her as COO, incredible partnership. I hope that I can replicate that type of friendship and partnership again in my career because it was so special. So after those 4 years, the company was a completely different size, stage, and scale than it was, of course, than when I started, right? And like, thank God, because that's what everyone dreams.
After those 4 years, give me a sense of the from to how many cities, how many markets were you in when she started versus 4 years later?
Yeah. I think we grew revenue by 400%. We had grown markets. I think when she started, we were in 10 cities. We opened 40 more, and then we opened internationally as well, which was a huge undertaking. The team grew from about 30 and doubled in that time to about 60, 65, even up close to 70. So she just had a tremendous impact. She is an exceptional operator and an exceptional person. And I trusted her. And trust was the key thing. We had built that trust over the course of 6 years, really, since the time that I met her. And so when the company was at a completely different size, stage, and scale, honestly, me as a founder, I love the early stages. I was starting to get bored again. I was starting to feel like, you know what? Like, other people can do this job. Like, I'm not having the unique impacts that I feel like I want to have on a daily basis. And literally, it goes back to that conversation around what makes me happy. And once I'm comfortable, that's when I'm not happy. And I was really comfortable with Stacy there and the company doing great and growing and scaling. And so I was pregnant with my second child. And I thought, you know what? Maybe this is a good excuse to switch gears a little bit, right? Like, I'll use my baby as an excuse. I'm feeling a little bored here in the day to day. Like, maybe this is the right time to think about it. And so I remember Stacy and I were coming back from a holiday party at the White House with the Obamas, and it was incredible. And we're flying
as you do, yeah.
as one does. I mean, if you look at my Instagram, like, it was such a cool moment. I took a photo of us, like in the bathroom at the White House, and I was just like, "Here we are, like at the holiday cocktail party." Amazing.
Do they have really good like hand towels and toilet paper?
Oh
and
my
stuff?
God, yeah! Like, and it was so funny because President Obama was like, "Whatever you do, don't steal the silver. This is the good China." He's like, people steal it in their purses. It was incredible. It was incredible. And her and I went together. We were flying back. This was in December of 2015. And I said to her on the plane, "Hey, this company is at a completely different scale. I think it needs to go to the next level. I think you can do that. How interested would you be in stepping up and stepping into the CEO role?" And she was like, "What? Like, what are you talking about?" And so we started the conversation then on the airplane, and then we kept talking. And then I told her in January, I didn't tell her at that time, I told her in January of that year, 2016, that I was actually pregnant too. And I felt like that might help as a catalyst. And then by February, we went to the board. And her and I had made the decision. We had made the decision. We both wanted this. We had put together a transition plan that we were really excited about. I wanted to separate out, actually, the pregnancy from the transition with my board. And so I remember a week before the board meeting, I called all my board members. And I was like, "Hey, just so you know, you're going to see me next week. And I'm going to look a little bit bigger." There's a reason for that.
It's got nothing to do with pizza or donuts, yeah, or beer.
Well, no, it did. There was definitely that. Not the beer. But there was a lot of pizza, donuts, and ice cream, for sure. And I said, but I didn't mention anything else about the transition, or, and of course they didn't ask, they would never ask. And so we got to the board meeting. They knew, you know, that I was pregnant. Stacy and I knew we had this plan that we wanted to take to them. And so we went into exec session without Stacy in the room. And I said, "Hey, there's something else I want to talk to you about. Company's in a great place. We had just had a great board meeting, an amazing 3-hour board meeting. Company's doing well. We're on the track to profitability, great cash position. We don't need to raise more money. We're just going to continue to scale." I said, "I think it's time for me to think about a transition in my role. I would really like to move to chair of the board." And they were pretty shocked and surprised. And it was funny because Andre Garkanian, who is our legal counsel at TaskRabbit, we met him actually through Floodgate. Andre is an incredible confidant, friend, mentor to me. I had called him 2 weeks before the board meeting. I said, "Hey, this is what's going to go down in exec session. I just want to give you the heads up. Do you have any advice? Do you think this is the right way to do it? Do you think I should do it one-on-one, or do you think I should just like drop this bomb in the meeting?" And he's like, "You know what? It's good to have everyone there and on the same page. Just do it in the meeting." And so we get to the meeting, and Andre's texting me through the meeting. We're like sitting across the table from each other, and he's like, "Hey, are you really going to do this? This was a like fantastic board meeting. Everyone is psyched. Everyone's pumped. And now you're going to drop this bomb on them that you want to transition your role. Like, are you sure?" And I looked at the text before we went into exec session, and I texted him back. I'm like, "Yeah, I'm doing it. Like, I feel really good about this. I feel super confident. And I trust Stacy. She is the right person to do this." And so we had the conversation in exec session. They were immediately like, "Well, what are you thinking? Do you want to run a process? Do you want to bring someone in? Or like, what about Stacy? Could Stacy do this?" You know, they immediately jumped to Stacy, and I was like, "Guys, I've got this. Like, this is the plan. Stacy's going to be amazing. She really wants this too. Let's work with her and figure out how to structure the transition." And so we did. And by April of that year, we had implemented the full transition plan. we went to the company at that point and we talked to the company and the team about what was happening. And of course, they knew Stacy really well. They had built so much trust with her too over time. And so this was something that was 6 years in the making and was handled with so much respect and gratitude and admiration for each other that Stacy and I had between each other. And we were able to then just do it so smoothly. And, you know, I stayed on as sort of a coach, an advisor to her. One thing that I think we did really well is I was like, you know what? I don't want to be the one that the team goes to and goes around your back. Like, you need the space. You're the CEO. I'm not going to be in the office
for a little while. Yeah. Or yeah, what I was like, do?
I can't be in the office anymore. I don't want to do one-on-ones with people. She was like, well, maybe you should do one-on-ones with sort of the key product leaders, you know, and you could get feedback on me and how I'm doing. I'm like, no, we're not doing that. You and I have a trusted relationship. I don't want you to ever feel like anyone is going behind your back and talking about you to me. And so we set very clear lines and boundaries that we came up with together. I got out of the office. I got out of the exec meetings, but I was there for her. And we would still meet every week, her and I, for breakfast. We'd talk about how things are going, where she needed help. If she just needed a vent or needed a sounding board, I was there. And we did that up until I had Ryan in August. So between April and August, I was like, there is the CEO coach. And then I went on maternity leave. And I fully made the transition and handed it over. And I showed up for that next board meeting that we had in November. And everything was humming along. And it just felt really good. So we did it in an incredible way. I don't know.
Very, very impressive, Leo.
I don't know how to replicate it, but that's how we did it. I think there are definitely learnings you can take from that.
Yeah. And then if you could, it's always tough to know. Did I lose you? Was it something I said?
Sorry. It was getting noisy outside.
Oh, I see. It's always tough to know should we or shouldn't we sell our company? And you had a red hot company when you sold it. So could you just give me a little bit of insight as to what made you and Stacy and obviously the board and your broader executive team decide, you know what, we're gonna do this, we're gonna sell the company?
Yeah. I mean, it was a tough decision, and it was a long process too. This isn't something that we decided overnight. The way it happened is the last thing I did before I fully transitioned to chair of the board, I was 4 or 5 months pregnant. It was early April, maybe late March, early April. And I flew out to Sweden to meet with IKEA because we wanted to kick off a partnership with them. And we wanted to run it out of the London office and do this in-store furniture assembly partnership. And we'd kind of been working this relationship for a year or two, and we kind of knew some people in the US office, but this was the first exposure we were getting to the global headquarters, which is where all the decisions are made at IKEA. And so I was like, you know what, I'm going to go by myself. I'll fly and kick off this partnership. And then Stacy and I knew that the handover was happening. I was like, I'll kick it off and then we'll transition it over and we'll go from there. And so we did that. And then that was April. And then we got Stacy and team built out that partnership in the London office through the end of that year and got the partnership launched by November. I remember because that board meeting, that next board meeting I had after I came back from maternity leave, we talked about how great the IKEA partnership was going. And then from there, it was going so well that, of course, IKEA was like, wow, maybe we should own this. And not just because the partnership was going well and we were driving revenue and increasing basket size and those sorts of things, but we had time to spend with them to realize that the two companies, IKEA and TaskRabbit, have a lot of shared values around culture, around impact, around the types of companies that we wanted to build for the future. And so that was really exciting. And so that was really the precipice and the catalyst for turning that into an acquisition conversation. And then from there, it took another 9 to 12 months to really understand what that would look like what the deal would look like, to get all the structure and components right. And so it was a lot of time that we had. We gave ourselves a lot of time and space to figure out, you know, what our priorities are. Are they aligned with IKEA's? Do we feel like we can be successful, even more successful on this bigger platform? The answer was yes. And so that was great. And it had been a decade, right? It had been a decade of running this business and understanding this business. And so it made sense, honestly, from a venture standpoint as well. Of course, our investors wanted to see, you know, some sort of return over time.
Right.
Yeah.
And if this is too personal, then just kick me under the table. But I assume it was a life-changing financial transaction for you as well.
I mean, yeah. I mean, listen, absolutely. And, you know, I grew up, as I mentioned, in a place where, like, none of this was ever a possibility or reality or even remotely within my context or mindset. And so, yeah, I mean, my husband and I, we look at each other sometimes and are like, we live in Silicon Valley now. My parents moved out here too. We've got like the whole family here. This is where we're building our lives and our careers. It's just like such a dramatic shift from everything we knew and we grew up with, which is kind of scary too, right? When you have kids, because you think about like, gosh, how are they going to grow up? What are the values we're going to instill in them? How are they going to be different? Their perspectives are totally different than how Kevin and I grew up.
Right. I assume there's a level of financial security that your children have that maybe you didn't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so there's, I don't know. I always think there's two sides to that coin, right? Like, it's incredibly exciting and really fulfilling. And then there's all these other things that you need to think about that come along with it.
Yep. Now, Leah, is there anything else you'd like to touch on before we kick out of this wave?
Anything else I'd like to touch on? I will mention one other project initiative that I'm working on that I think is high impact, particularly at this time, and really valuable. And it's this concept called Shine Together. And it comes from the inspiration behind President Obama's administration, and specifically Valerie Jarrett, who was a senior advisor to President Obama. She had this whole philosophy in his administration about the women shining on each other and amplifying each other's voices in meetings to get their ideas across, get their ideas heard. And so it's early, but myself and my co-founder Jamie have been working with Valerie to launch this initiative called Shine Together that focuses on amplifying the stories of everyday women doing incredible things. And I just have this strong philosophy and feeling that technology is at a point today that gives us control over a global message. And for so long, we have been under the media's control over what to listen to, what messages are heard, what is reported on, whose stories get told. And we have an opportunity now as a society to take control of the stories and voices that we hold dear and that we want to help amplify. And so I'll leave that as just something I've been thinking a lot about. And I think something that could be impactful to the future is just to shine on each other, to shine together, and to think about how you can help amplify sort of those next generation of voices and of people.
Well, I love that you're saying this. I love that you're doing this. I couldn't agree more. I think it's, we live at a time where, you know, listen, I got thrown out of school at 18 and I am now the head of a media empire.
You know, that's right.
With a laptop and, you know, with a relatively small amount of money.
Right.
If you do something of value, in the case of this podcast or, you know, my books or those kinds of things, you can reach a huge part of the world. And to your point, a huge part of our mission here on Legends and Losers is to shine a light on things people don't talk about, whether it's the losery or whether it's people who are doing incredible things that you couldn't hear before. You made the comment earlier, you know, you do a lot of media. You're a highly trained, successful person. But you're on for 2 minutes when you're on TV or the radio,
right?
And because of podcasting, because of self-publishing, we can just do things that we can have a voice that we could never have before. And yeah. And I think that's incredibly powerful. It's a huge part of my motivation, Leah, and I'm stoked to hear you doing it. And are you launching a podcast out of curiosity?
Maybe someday. I mean, I don't know. No, not right now, but maybe someday. I mean, the idea is to maybe find ways via platform, whether that's web, audio, video, something where we can actually be the platform that amplifies and shares these stories. So right now we have a little website called shinetogether.us, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Well, you let me know if we can help. You know, awesome. Consider Legends and Losers your podcast until such time as you have one of your own. Whether
awesome.
It's, you know, if you have a great fuel company that you think would be make a great conversation here, or any of these other gals that you're running into that you think you particularly want to shine a light on, that would be someone great to come on Legends and Losers. I'd be open to that. I love your mission.
Cool.
I love what you've done. Your track record, your history is incredibly inspiring, and I think you're fucking awesome.
Thank you. I mean, thank you so much for having me and letting me share my story, and I just love chatting with you, so thank you.
Well, Leah, you're amazing. Thank you so much. Come back anytime you want, and like I said, we're open to any guest suggestions you have going forward.
Cool. Sounds good.
Be legendary, my friend.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Whew. Man, isn't she awesome? If you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, why not share it on social media right now? Your shares directly impact the growth of this podcast, and we appreciate it deeply. Also, we're going to start doing some more question and answer episodes. So if you would like me to answer one of your questions, or at least have a shot at getting me to answer it, send an email. You never know. It could get lost in the black hole. Somebody could have been drinking that day. But if we're paying attention, send your question to blackhole@legendsandlosers.com, and we will do our best to get you on your question answered on the podcast. You can always follow me as well at Lockhead, LOCHHEAD, on Twitter. Now, is it grow time in your business? Check out netsuite.com/legends to schedule your free growth review, because there's nothing more important than figuring out not just how to turbocharge your growth, but how to grow the right way. Do you expand your product lines? Do you increase your geographies? Do you add more sales capabilities, maybe more digital channels? These are all things to consider. And in a recent study by SL Associates, NetSuite customers reported stunning improvements in key performance metrics after switching to NetSuite, because when you do your business in the cloud, good things happen. As a matter of fact, the study found that NetSuite customers, on average, experienced a 10% increase in revenue. That sounds tasty. I was going to say that. I guess that does sound tasty. 10% increase in revenue, an 80% increase in business insights. And who doesn't need more business insights? And a stunning 5% growth in gross margins. So NetSuite customers, bottom line, they have it going on. And if you want to get it going on, particularly get your growth going on, check out netsuite.com/legends to schedule your 1 hour growth review with an expert in your industry. netsuite.com/legends. All right. We would like to thank the good people at Fuel Capital, Leah's company. Check them out. They're an early stage venture capital firm dedicated to giving outsiders the inside edge. Check out fuelcapital.com. Amazon number one bestseller, written by Heather Clancy and me. Niche Down, How to Become Legendary by Being Different. Check it out. You've done dumber things with $15 at nichedownbook.com, or just go to amazon.com and type in Niche Down. Verve Coffee, the leader in West Coast craft coffee. Verve is the official coffee of Legends and Losers for a reason, in Santa Cruz, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Tokyo, and always at vervecoffee.com. The amazing people at onelifefullylived.org. This is my dear buddy Tim Rhodes, a nonprofit that I've been involved with from the very beginning. We want to help people get a hold of their financial situation, dream, plan, and live their best life so that, you know what? They can have it all, because who said we can't have it all? Check out onelifefullylived.org. My new spinoff, the spinoff of Legends and Losers, 6 minutes of Legendary, an incredible new audio experience where we take clips from Legends and Losers and set them to music. This is the brainchild of the incredibly talented Nick Cullen. Check out 6 minutes of Legendary on Apple Podcasts exclusively. Speaking of Nick Cullen, Second Flight Consultancy. You know, if you're going to have a podcast, you should probably learn how to talk. Nick Cullen is a growth hacking genius. He and his team will help you growth hack your way to new heights. Check out secondflightconsultancy.com. Equity Directory, if you're in the startup ecosystem, if you want to connect with people who are willing to help you build your startup for primarily equity in their compensation, check out equitydirectory.com. Category Design Advisors. These are my buddies. This is Kevin Maney, Mike Damphouse, and their band of brothers. They do legendary strategery on how to design and dominate new categories. Check out CategoryDesignAdvisors.com. Is it time for you to get an assistant? You need help? I know I need a lot of help. Check out Bottleneck Virtual Assistants at bottleneck.online. Why not leverage the power of a virtual assistant today? And the incredible people at Kiva.org, microfinance loans that make a difference in the developing world to small e entrepreneurs. Check out KIV.org. All right, I got to remind you that this oddcast is the sole property of the Legends and Losers Oddcast Network, and we would love you just a little bit extra if you shared the shit out of it, if you wrote us a review, and, you know, generally, every time you do something to help us, it makes a giant difference, so thank you. We got to remind you that all rights do remain disturbed, and we must warn you that this oddcast is clearly produced in a studio that does contain nuts. Please teach entrepreneurship. Remember to support your local venture capitalist, save water, and shower with a friend. Don't fry bacon in the naked. Yeah, don't fry bacon in the naked. Remember, when opportunity knocks, open the door. I love you, Dandy Candy. Thank you so much, Mom and Dad, or the other way around, or both. And hey, Colin, this oddcast really ties the room together, doesn't it? Today, our deepest apologies go out to Hugh Martin of Verizon Communications. Sorry, Hugh, we just ran out of time for you. That's it, my friends. Thank you so much for investing your life with us. It really means the world to me, and I'll see you again soon on Legends and Losers.